What is up, Ninja Nerd fam? We're here for episode 9. We're back for more. We're talking today about shock. All types of shock. It's going to be a lot of fun. But remember, guys, before we get started, please check out our website, ninjanerd.org. We got lecture notes, illustrations, everything you need to really learn a little bit more. Hopefully, we can keep doing that for you. So please go ahead and check that out before we get started. Without further ado, we're going to be talking about shock. But before we get into it, Zach, how are you feeling today, man?
I am tired. I just got done with my overnights over the weekend, and it was nice to be able to come into work right afterwards. And you and Kristen got together a nice little bed for me to sleep in my office.
Guys, it's no joke. I was like, Zach, I'm meeting you halfway here, because normally he goes home after like a weekend shift and he sleeps the entire Monday, like all day Monday.
Yep. Nothing's happening on Monday. No work.
So I'm like, look, you know what? Let's try and make this a little bit better. We got him a little twin bed in his room. We'll have to throw up a picture. It's hilarious.
Get my couple hours, my little power nap, and I'm ready to roll, man.
So, you know, we're here, energy drink in hand. We're ready to knock out another episode. So, Zach, let's get right into it, man. Tell me a little bit about what is shock, the definition, and then introduce us all to the four types of circulatory shock.
Yeah, so when we talk about the different types of shock, there's four basic types of shock. When you have hypovolemic shock, you have cardiogenic shock, obstructive shock, and then distributive shock. And distributive has kind of like three subgroups to it. You have septic shock, anaphylactic shock, and then neurogenic shock. When we talk about the basic like pathophysiology behind shock, shock is basically like simply defined as inadequate perfusion to the tissues. So you're not delivering enough blood to the actual tissues, delivering oxygen, nutrients to those tissues. And over time, they become ischemic. They stop being able to work properly. And then obviously, as the tissue starts to fail, tissues make up organs, organs start to fail, multiple organs start to fail, and you develop multi-organ system dysfunction. And so that's one of the downsides about shock, is there's this inadequate perfusion to the tissues. The different types of shock can actually be like a little bit more like classified further. Like when we talk about hypovolemic shock, it's actually within the name. Your low volume, whether that's like low plasma volume from losses that may not be super obvious sometimes. For example, you'd be losing fluid from the GIT. So excessive amounts of vomiting or diarrhea could be one source, or you're losing it from the skin. So excessive sweating. Maybe you had like a third degree burn on most of the areas of your body, like Rob did when we were down in Hawaii.
I got burned. Like literally I toast.
You look like a lobster.
It was worth it, man. Hawaii was beautiful.
Yeah, that was awesome. So that could be a couple ways, right? You'd be losing it from your skin, like nasty third degree burns, super like significant insensible losses from like high fevers and being diaphoretic. Other things is you could be third spacing a lot of fluid. So like pancreatitis, a lot of the times they develop like this massive inflammatory state that they just allow for a lot of the fluid that's in their vasculature to leak out of the vasculature. So that's going to drop your actual blood volume. And the other thing is losing a lot of volume through the kidneys. So sometimes if people are on like massive amounts of diuretics, or they're just peeing massive amounts, that could be one way. The other thing is, we're not talking about volume losses, we're talking about blood. That's another big thing. So if you're losing blood, that's usually going to be obviously looking for any kind of obvious trauma. Any traumatic incident where you're losing blood internally is going to be a struggle. Looking for blood that's actually coming out of the GIT. So GI bleeds are a big source of sometimes hypovolemic shock as well. Blood coming out from the actual genital urinary tract as well. So sometimes if patients have massive like pelvic bleeding, particularly like post usually like cesarean sections, or usually after birth, so like postpartum hemorrhage. Those would be some particular things to watch out for. So that's your hypovolemic shock. And the basic concept that happens with these is, regardless of the cause, you're losing volume, losing blood. When you drop your blood volume, you basically reduce the total volume of blood that's actually being returned to the heart. So the venous return starts to drop, and that basically is your preload. So as your preload drops, your stroke volume drops, your cardiac output drops, and as cardiac output drops, your blood pressure drops. And again, your blood pressure is what's really kind of leading to this concept of perfusion, particularly something called MAP, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, Rob. But what happens is you're not perfusing those tissues because you have a low MAP, a mean arterial pressure. And that's what leads to this kind of symptoms of shock. The other one is cardiogenic. And cardiogenic, I think it's a heart problem. There's a pump problem. Something's not working well with the heart. And in these situations with cardiogenic shock, it's usually something like, think about the myocardium. It's dysfunctional in some way. It's not contracting well. And so in these kinds of situations, you think about like a big honking MI. So you have a big clot within like the LAD. You think about another thing like very terrible, like heart failure with a very low EF. Those could be potential things like dilated cardiomyopathy sometimes. If you have like a really bad myocarditis, but I think the easiest one to remember is usually just a big whopping MI. Other things that actually can cause cardiogenic shock too is whenever your heart is beating at a really fast rate. So sometimes if you're super, super tachycardic, like in patients who have like AFib with RVR, or they also can have atrial flutter or VTAC, in those situations, you're beating at such a fast rate that you don't allow for adequate diastolic filling. And that basically leads to a reduction in your actual proper return or stroke volume within the heart. And again, that could drop your cardiac output. So when we think about these two primary reasons for cardiogenic shock, it's either a pump problem, because your myocardium is failing, it's not able to contract blood out of the heart. And so that drops your stroke volume, that'll drop your cardiac output, drop your MAP. Or your heart rate is beating at such a fast rate where you're not allowing for an adequate diastolic filling, you're dropping its preload, you're dropping the stroke volume, dropping the cardiac output, and then again, dropping the MAP. The other thing that's a really big one to remember for cardiogenic shock is acute like regurgitation of a mitral valve or an acute regurgitation of the aortic valve. Those will cause like very significant hemodynamic instability in these patients. So that's another one to watch out for. So again, with the cardiogenic, look for a pump problem, whether it be from the myocardium, like a big whopping MI, or acute heart failure. Think about a heart rate that's way too fast. So like AFib with RVR, atrial flutter, maybe like a VTAC, any of those kinds of situations. And then lastly, think about like a valvular dysfunction, especially acute mitral regurgitation or acute aortic regurgitation for the cardiogenic. The next category of shock is the obstructive shock. So this is basically an extra cardiac issue. So it's not a problem with the heart per se. It's maybe things around the heart, the lungs, the pericardium, and the great vessels that are outside of the heart. So your aorta, your pulmonary artery, kind of those areas, Rob, that can kind of lead to problems where you aren't able to get blood out of the heart. So what do I mean by that? With obstructive shock, you think about three particular disorders. This is the way I think about it. One is think about the pericardium. That's around the heart. Second, think about the lungs. That's around the heart. And then third thing is think about the pulmonary artery. So these are the three areas that can lead to obstructive shock. So if you have a lot of fluid within the pericardial cavity that accumulates rapidly and it squeezes on the heart in a condition called cardiac tamponade, it's going to squeeze the heart, prevent it from being able to fill. That reduces its venous return, its stroke volume, cardiac output, and then low MAPs. You don't perfuse. Over time, that can lead to shock. The other one is a tension pneumothorax. So if the lungs, you develop a nice little collapse of the lung and it's starting to smash and push things on one side to the opposite side to the other cavity. That's going to squeeze in the heart, reduce the venous return, reduce the stroke volume, reduce the cardiac output, reduce the MAP. And then again, you don't perfuse the tissues over time. And the last one is a pulmonary embolism, like a really big like saddle embolus or at least a proximal pulmonary artery embolus. In those situations, you aren't able to get any blood out of the right side of the heart. So think about that. You get blood into the right side of the heart properly, but you have a big fat embolus that's not allowing any blood to go into the pulmonary arteries. You can't get any blood to go to the pulmonary arteries. No blood will come back for the other pulmonary veins. No blood will get into the left atrium. No blood will get into the left ventricle. There's basically no preload, no stroke volume, no cardiac output, no MAP. And then again, usually these patients may PEA arrest. So that's, again, another situation where you can see this type of shock, obstructive shock. So again, with obstructive, it's not necessarily a cardiac issue. It's things around the heart, pericardium, lungs, and again, last but not least, that pulmonary artery. The last category of shock is distributive shock. And the best way to think about these is that this is a vasodilatory type of shock. So with hypovolemic, they were volume down, whether it be blood or plasma. Cardiogenic, the heart stinks and it wasn't able to pump blood out. Obstructive is something was basically either compressing the heart or blocking blood flow out of the heart. And then with distributive, all the heart's pretty much fine. But what's going on here is the vessels are super dilated and they're super leaky. And when they're super dilated, what happens with vessels that are dilated is that their resistance to blood flow drops. And if you don't have a lot of resistance to blood flow, what's called systemic vascular resistance, your blood pressure will tank. And then they also just leak a lot of fluid into their cap, like out of their interstitial spaces. And so with these, there's three types. One is septic shock. And this is obviously in a patient who has a nasty infection. We'll talk about areas where you should be concerned. Anaphylactic shock is they have like a massive allergic reaction to some type of allergen. And then the last one is neurogenic shock. They have some type of like spinal cord or brain, like some type of central nervous system injury that leads to an alteration within the tone of their vessels and their heart. And so with these are the distributive types of shocks. And again, we'll get into these in a little bit more detail, but that gives us the basic like pathophysiology, Rob, the causes, the types of shock, and the basic definition of shock.
All right. Don't worry, guys. I am still here. That was a lot. And, yeah. But hey, shock is no easy topic. It's a lot of things going on. So we're going to try and really go step by step here. The next area we're hoping to get into, Zach, please tell us a little bit about some of the key signs, symptoms, vitals that really make your spidey sense go off.
Yeah. I mean, shock is definitely a huge topic. It's pretty much the reason I have a job in the ICU. So we deal with this a lot. And so, yeah, there's a lot of things that I think when you see patients and you walk in the bed, you walk into the room, you look at them, there might be certain things that like cue you off to say, hey, I'm a little nervous right here. They look a little shocky. And so some of the things I look at is right away their vitals. So looking at their vitals, I look at their blood pressure. So obviously systolic blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure, those are great numbers to look at, but often they don't tell me about the true perfusion to an organ. And so what I prefer to look at is not necessarily the actual systolic and diastolic blood pressure. I like to look at the MAP, the mean arterial pressure, because that's really what's my perfusion pressure. So I'll look at that. The other thing I'll look at is my heart rate. So sometimes when patients' blood pressure drops, they create a reflexive tachycardia, because basically when their blood pressure drops, their baroreceptors say like, holy crap, the blood pressure is really low. We got to jack up the heart rate to increase our cardiac output and our blood pressure. And so sometimes you'll see that they have a high heart rate and a low blood pressure. And that's actually very helpful, especially when I walk in the room and I see that I see a very low BP, I see a very low MAP, and I see a high heart rate. There's something called a shock index. And I can basically utilize that shock index to make me a little bit more concerned for a patient being in some type of concerning state of the shock. So I'll look at that a lot of the time. The other thing I'll do is I'll look at their respiratory rate. So sometimes this is a big one for me. Whenever patients really are potentially acidotic from not perfusing tissues, they may build up some lactate. And lactate, generally, there's actually it's the base of a particular acid called lactic acid. So lactic acid will actually give off a proton, become lactate, but we measure lactate levels. What happens is whenever you have a lactic acidosis, that basically tells your chemoreceptors, hey, the body is really acidic right now. We need to breathe faster to blow off some of the CO2 to be able to bring my pH back up. And so one of the things that I'll really look at is the patient's respiratory rate. Are they tachypneic? Are they look like they're working really hard to breathe and they're breathing in the rates of like the 30s to 40s? That's another concerning sign, because that's a big thing to help me to determine if they might have an underlying acidosis. The other thing I'll look at is their temp. So I want to know right off the get-go, if a patient looks septic and I see a very high shock index, so again, I see like a very high heart rate and a very low systolic blood pressure, I see that they're breathing at a fast rate, I also see that they have a high temp, I start to kind of get in this kind of like SIRS criteria area where I'm starting to see like, again, low blood pressure, high heart rate, high respiratory rate, and I see a fever. These are also concerning signs as well. So if I see a fever, I'm starting to think potentially about like an underlying septic shock. Then I look at the SpO2. That's another really big one for me. So what I like to look at is a couple things, Rob. It's something I've kind of learned and I've unfortunately missed a couple times, but I want to not only know like what's their actual O2 saturation, because that's a great thing to know, but I want to know where the actual like O2 sat like probe is at. So I want to know, is it on their fingers? Because oftentimes when people get really like shocky, their perfusion to the tissues, especially like the skin, the fingers, those tips of the fingers, they get really, really poor perfusion. And so if I notice that the actual like SpO2 thing is not on their finger and they have it like on a nose or on a forehead or on an ear or something like that, I get a little bit nervous, because that's starting to show me that their perfusion isn't getting really well, isn't very good. So I get a little concerned with that. So those are the things right away when I walk into the room and I see a high shock index, low blood pressure, high heart rate, I see a fast respiratory rate, I see a high temp, I see SpO2 that maybe is normal, but again, I want to know where the actual SpO2 like probe is. Is it on the nose? Is it on the ear? Is it not on the finger? Because that might make me a little bit concerned. And that leads me to the next thing. I'll go to the patient and I'll look at their skin. This is a big one for me. I like to look at the actual knees. I like to look at the shins. I like to look at the fingers, and I like to see, do they look mottled? Do they look cold? Are they pale? Do they have clammy, cold kind of extremities? Is their capillary refill really poor? And so these are some of the big things that I'll look for, because it helps me to determine if they're kind of like in a cold shock, they're not perfusing tissues, or they're more of like a warm shock. So sometimes we'll use the term like septic shock is a more of a warm shock, because they're vasodilating their vessels and they have a lot of blood flow into the area of the tissues. So sometimes in a septic shock patient, they may have kind of more warm, well-perfused extremities. Whereas in a patient who has kind of a cold shock, so this would be your hypovolemic shocks, your obstructive shocks, your cardiogenic shocks, their cardiac output stinks. And so the way that they try to increase their blood pressure is squeezing down on their vessels. And unfortunately, the vessels that we don't care about in a fight or flight situation is our skin vessels. And so those things get clamped down and then they start to look pale. They start to have cold extremities and they start to have just very poor capillary refill perfusion to the skin. And so those are things I look at very, very significantly. If I start seeing that, again, I'm more concerned as well. I think the other thing is important is to be able to assess for any target organ damage. So whenever your perfusion is dropping, there's certain organs that I think get hit very quickly. And I think one of the big ones is the brain. So not only look at their vitals, not only look at their skin, and also I would really try to be able to assess their mental status, their orientation. Are they confused? Are they altered? Are they having any neurodeficits? Are they having any kinds of changes in their baseline mentation? That's a really important thing, because as you don't perfuse the brain, you start to see confusion, disorientation, and these are big, big signs that you're not perfusing the brain properly. The second one is the kidneys. I look at that Foley if they have one in, and I look to see, are they making adequate amount of urine? Because if their blood pressure is low, if their MAP's low, or they're not perfusing that kidney, their urine production is going to stink. And so I look a lot at that as well. And then again, the other thing that we'll talk about a little bit later is I want to know, are they perfusing the tissue super well? Because sometimes in these patients who are really shocky and they're not perfusing those tissues well, they don't give oxygen to the tissues. Because if, again, if your perfusion's low, you're not giving oxygen nutrients to the tissues. Oxygen is needed to be able to make ATP. If the oxygen delivery to the tissues is actually diminished or decreased because you're in a shock state, you're going to start going through a lot of like anaerobic mechanisms. And this will actually lead to a production of lactic acid. And so that's another thing that I'll actually consider within my workup, is checking a lactate level to see, is there any signs of inadequate tissue perfusion? And there is some debate about if that's a real thing, but we're not going to go down that road. But yeah, that's kind of the ways that I'll look at my patients there, Rob.
Alrighty, gotcha. So hemodynamic parameters, blah. But we got to know it, right? You have to know it. So let's say Zach is working a shift in the neuroscience ICU. He heads into a room and he wants to throw a massive swan into a patient's IJ to differentiate the types of shock. Zach, do you feel this massive beast of a catheter really gives you guidance? Is it really beneficial?
I mean, in the boards, sure. But in reality, no, we're not throwing in like swans in every single patient to determine which type of shock they have. I think you just need to have a lot more like cognitive thinking and try not to get too stuck in that rabbit hole of looking at numbers like CVPs and things like that. But I think it's something that's for your boards. I think it's actually worth remembering. But I think when it comes to truly differentiating a type of shock, I don't think it's absolutely necessary. And really, there's possibly really no reason to do swans anymore. I think a lot of the literature supports that, but they are used often in patients with cardiogenic shock. But we'll talk about them really briefly, about some of the parameters that you may need to know for your actual exam. So when you talk about hypovolemic shock, whenever you throw a swan into somebody's actual like IJ, it runs down the IJ, runs into the right atrium, right ventricle, runs up into like a pulmonary artery. And then what this thing can do is it can give you different types of numbers or parameters and get you something called a central venous pressure. And that's basically the right atrial pressure. It can give you a pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which is like your left atrial pressure. It can give you a cardiac index, which is like your cardiac output. You can also measure the mixed oxygen saturation, which is your SCVO2 or SVO2. And then another thing you can do is, again, sometimes you can measure something like systemic vascular resistance. But the big things here is going to be, again, CVP, pulmonary capillary wedge, cardiac index, and SVO2. So with these, it's very straightforward. Hypovolemic, their volume down. So their return to the right side of the heart stinks. So their central venous pressure is low. On top of that, because they have low venous return, not just to the right side of the heart, but they're also going to have low venous return to the left side of the heart, their pulmonary capillary wedge pressure will also be low. And because in general, you have a low venous return, that's going to lead to a low stroke volume, a low cardiac output. And so if they have a low cardiac output, their cardiac index will also be low as well. The SVO2 is a stupid thing, but generally it's a measure of cardiac output, but it also is looking at oxygen extraction in the tissues. And so generally, if someone has a poor cardiac output, their tissues have more time to extract oxygen from the actual capillaries. So what happens is you push blood out of the left ventricle, goes to the tissues, comes back to the right side of the heart, and you can measure the oxygen extraction basically. And so what you look at is if they had a low cardiac output, now those tissues have plenty of time to yank some of the oxygen from the capillaries. And when the blood goes back to the right side of the heart, the amount of oxygen that's actually in the blood is going to be a lot lower because you had an ample amount of time to yank some of the oxygen out. So that's usually pretty common with a low cardiac output. So you would have these patients have a low SVO2. And then lastly, any kind of cold shock, so your hypovolemic, your cardiogenic, and your obstructive shocks will all have a high systemic vascular resistance. They're all trying to clamp on those vessels to compensate for their low perfusions. Okay, so that's the big thing with that one. Cardiogenic, the heart stinks. It can't get blood out of the heart, right? And so because of that, think about it. If you can't get blood out of the right side of the heart, your central venous pressure is going to be high because you're going to have a lot of blood in the heart. If you have, a lot of blood in the left side of the heart because you're not able to get it out, your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure will also be high. And then if you can't get blood out of the heart, your cardiac output's low. So your cardiac index is also going to be low. And then again, if your cardiac output's low, you're not allowing for a good amount of blood flow to go to the tissues. So the tissues will have ample amount of time to yank as much oxygen out of those capillaries. So the oxygen going back to the right side of the heart will be low. So the SVO2 will be low. Obstructive shock. Again, having a difficult time really with these can be somewhat complicated, but in general, usually there's a venous return problem. You can't get blood into the right side of the heart for all of these, or you can't get blood out of the right ventricle because of a pulmonary embolism. In those situations, the central venous pressures will pretty much always be high. The pulmonary capillary wedge pressure can be variable, and pretty much in most of them, it's low, except for in cardiac tamponade, sometimes this can actually be a little bit high. I wouldn't go too deep down that rabbit hole though. With general though, all of these is most of them, there's again a drop in the venous return with the tension pneumothorax or cardiac tamponade, and there is a high afterload. So either way, blood is not getting out of the heart well. So their stroke volume sucks, and that would actually cause, again, a drop in their cardiac output, so they'll have a low cardiac index. And again, because they have a low cardiac output, ample amount of time for the tissues to yank oxygen out of the capillary, so the amount of oxygen that's going back to the heart afterwards is going to be low. And last but not least, thank goodness, distributive shock. The most common one out of all of these is going to be septic shock. So in septic shock, these patients are just third spacing a lot of fluid. A lot of the actual volume of blood that's in the vessels, fluid with inside of the vessels, are leaking out because they're so dilated and so leaky. In those situations, think about that. If you have leaky and dilated vessels, you're not going to get a lot of blood back to the heart. Okay. And so because of that, the right side of the heart pressures are going to be low and the left side heart pressures are going to be low. So you'll have low CVPs and low pulmonary capillary wedge pressures. But because they're so vasodilated, their sympathetic nervous system is on hyperdrive. And the way that they try to increase their actual blood pressure is by getting the heart to slam every drop of blood out of it. And so their cardiac output is just hyperdynamic. They are crushing blood out of their heart. And so they have a high cardiac index. The other thing with these is because their cardiac output is just smashing blood out, the blood is going to be so hyperdynamic through the actual capillaries that the tissues are like, oh my gosh, I don't have time to pull any oxygen out. And by the time the actual blood gets back to the right side of the heart and you sample off the oxygen, their SVO2 is generally going to be a little bit higher. So that would be the ways that we would describe these, Rob. Again, I would not go deep down this rabbit hole for your boards. It is actually somewhat significant in differentiating these, but in true clinical reality, I don't think that's very helpful.
Yeah. So in reality, not everyone's going to go ahead and buy themselves a Swan.
No.
But as far as your boards go, hey, you got to know it. So you might as well just suck it up.
Yeah. Suck it up, memorize it, guys, and just move on.
So overall, Zach, what's a realistic way to work up these types of shock in a real meaningful manner? I think we're all dying to know, what is the Zach Murphy approach here?
So my approach, I don't know, it's pretty straightforward. I try not to make it too complicated. When I look at these patients, I don't really use a Swan or kind of those numbers really. I kind of just, again, try to think about the causes. So I either have a hypovolemic shock, right? So a lot of the time, history is key here. So asking them questions, have you had any excessive vomiting, diarrhea? Have you been having excessive use of diuretics that you're a little bit more volume down right now? Have you had any third degree burns, or have you noticed any fevers or diaphoresis? Anything like that would be super, super helpful. But if you're looking for blood loss, obviously you have to go find the actual blood loss. And so one of the first things that you can do is get a CBC, see if they drop their hemoglobin. It would be nice if you had something to compare it to, what their prior hemoglobin was, but getting a CBC to determine if a patient's bleeding would be helpful. Sometimes you can get coags, certain types of coags to help you to determine if there is any kind of abnormality within their hemostasis pathways. Those can be somewhat beneficial in a patient, depending upon what kind of medications they're on, especially if they're on anticoagulants. And then the other thing is imaging, figuring out where the bleed is. Do I need to get like an EGD to figure out if they have like an upper GI bleed? Do I need to get a colonoscopy to see if they have a lower GI bleed? Do I need to get like a CT of their abdomen and pelvis to make sure that they don't have like a retroperitoneal bleed? And, you know, did they rupture some type of artery, like an aneurysm within their abdomen? So going through and looking for all of these things are super important. For cardiogenic, it's relatively straightforward with these. Again, you end up finding something going on with the heart. So are they having like a super high heart rate that's not giving them an adequate time to fill? EKG. That's a pretty straightforward thing. The other thing is an EKG will help you determine if they have like a big whopping MI. So those would be things that I look for there. Echo is also going to be super helpful because it'll tell you if there's any kind of like mechanical problems. If they have like an acute mitral regurg, an acute, aortic regurgitation, it'll also tell you if they have like an acute left heart failure and their ejection fractions in the dookie, in the dump. So those are kind of like big things that I would look at. Obstructive shock. Again, you're looking for a tension pneumo. Oftentimes this is a clinical thing, but if you go to the bedside and you see that they have a big plump JVD or jugular vein, and then you also notice they don't have press sounds on one side, the trachea is deviated, they're hypotensive, tachycardic, that would potentially be a tension pneumo, but you can get a chest x-ray if you really want to confirm. Cardiac tamponade, I've been like echo. You're looking for any kind of like massive amount of like fluid or blood within the actual pericardial cavity that's causing the collapse of those chambers during diastole. That would help you to diagnose cardiac tamponade. And then again, if you have a concern for a pulmonary embolus, you can get a CTPA to rule that out. Septic shock is a little bit more difficult sometimes. Again, you want to kind of look at these patients very carefully. Oftentimes with these patients, a CBC might be helpful. They may have an elevated white count. So that may be one thing, especially if they have like a left shift. There's a lot of band cells out there. The other thing is really trying to figure out, do they have evidence of like bacteremia? Because if they do have this, you want to look for the source of the infection that's causing them to become super like hemodynamically unstable. They must have a lot of bacteremia. So getting like blood cultures, I think would be a really important thing to do right up front, but then also figuring out cultures from other areas. So maybe blood is definitely what we want, but make sure that you actually test other areas. Do they have like a pyelonephritis that leaked into the blood? Maybe that's the source and you have to treat the pylo. So getting potentially like a urine analysis and maybe even urine cultures would be beneficial. Do they have a big whopping pneumonia because they aspirated or they have some type of like nasty abscess within the lungs? Maybe get a sputum culture, get a chest x-ray. But again, I think it's really just finding the source of the sepsis. So sometimes in these patients who you're like, man, they have a high white count, they're, you know, they look septic, they're hypotensive, they're tachycardic, they have a lactate buildup, they have a leukocytosis, and, you know, their blood cultures are pending. I don't know what's going on with them. Sometimes you can just get like a CT of their abdomen and pelvis and even of their chest to really see if you can find anything within the lungs, anything within the abdomen, the pelvis, to look for any kind of like septic focus. Those kinds sometimes would be like little helpful tips to do. With anaphylactic and neurogenic, it's really just history and physical. I mean, if someone actually is like, you know, comes in and they're like, they look swollen, look like they've been stung by like 17,000 bees, that might be super obvious. Or they say that they, you know, took a medication that they were just recently prescribed and it's a common medication that could do that. Sometimes it's be super obvious off their history and physical that if they're wheezing, they have angioedema, they have like hives. And again, they look hypotensive and tachycardic. That might be pretty obvious. Neurogenic shock is a really tough one. It's actually relatively rare. But again, I think it's looking at the history, looking for any kind of like spinal cord injury, looking for any kind of brain injuries or traumatic brain injuries in that sense, looking for the obvious, like, and this is one of those times like where tachycardia may not actually be the common feature in these patients. They may be bradycardic. And so neurogenic shock, they typically are bradycardic and also hypotensive. So again, sometimes if you really want to find out what's going on with these patients, you can get like a CT or MRI of their brain and spinal cord to see if there's anything going on there. But yeah, that's kind of my like approach, Rob. I'd say out of these, the more common ones that you're probably most likely going to see is hypovolemic, septic shock, and cardiogenic shock. So usually getting starting off with a CBC, maybe getting images to rule out any kind of occult bleeding, EKG echo, and then again, usually cultures to rule out any kind of septic focus, I think, and then maybe imaging. Those are kind of like my beginning steps for working up a shock patient.
All right, Ninja Nerds, let's move into treatment now. Let's start to wrap this podcast episode up, kind of get to the good stuff here. So another scenario for you guys, all right? So again, Zach's on his shift. He's a neuroscience ICU, heads into a patient's room. Their BP is 20 over dead, MAPS in the shitter. What is the systematic treatment? What do you have to do for this patient? Zach, give it to us.
That's awesome. So, yeah, when I think about these patients, obviously hypovolemic shock, if you're thinking that that's the cause, give them volume. So giving them some IV fluids is going to be beneficial. I'd say just, again, be careful with the fluids. I think if it's definitely hypovolemic shock, it'll be helpful. If it's really like the massive diarrhea, massive vomiting, massive like sweating or insensible losses from those kinds of things, that might be a beneficial thing. But if they're bleeding, you got to give them blood product, and then you got to figure out what's actually causing the bleeding and then treat that. So generally, that's pretty much the big things here is for hypovolemic shock. It's all fluids. If it's, regardless if it's blood or like just plasma volume, give them IV fluids. And then again, if they're actually losing blood, give them blood products. But again, figure out why they're bleeding and then again, treat that cause. Usually I would, if you have a vasopressor on a patient who's in hypovolemic shock, I'd be pretty scared that they're imminently going to die on you anytime soon. So when you have vasopressors on a patient and you're rapidly titrating those and a patient who has hypovolemic shock, you're not treating them properly. You need to figure out what's going on with them and definitely like secure whatever the bleed is that's going on in these patients, because they will die on you. Cardiogenic shock. For these patients, again, it's treating the cause. If they have a big whopping MI, like have a STEMI, I need to get them to the cath lab. I need to be able to, you know, open up those vessels and snake out that clot. If it's another thing, like they're in acute heart failure, figuring out why they're in acute heart failure and treating that. And then again, if it's some other kind of cause, like an acute mitral regurgitation or aortic regurgitation, maybe like a valve repair or replacement. If they're in AFib with RVR and they're beating at 180 beats per minute and they're hypotensive as all crap, that might be something that I need to treat them with again. So again, I think treating the underlying cause is a big thing. Sometimes what you'll see is these patients who do have like a low EF. So they're in heart failure. They have an MI. Inotropes may be beneficial, dobutamine, milrinone. Sometimes if their pressure gets a little bit low with those because they can vasodilate, you can give things like norepinephrine to be able to help to give a little bit of squeeze. If they have a lot of pulmonary edema because they're backing fluid up in their lungs because they can't get out of their heart, sometimes BiPAP is somewhat beneficial for that, as well as diuretics. This is probably one of those times where you wouldn't want to give them tons of fluids because you can actually just push it right into the lungs and put them in more respiratory distress. So I would actually more likely diurese if you're going to kind of pull fluid off these patients. And again, you have to treat the cause. But if you don't treat the cause, you're not going to actually improve the patient. So again, if they're in AFib with RVR and they're hypotensive, hemodynamically unstable, you shock them. You know, if they have a big whopping MI, you get them to the cath lab. If they have a mitral and aortic regurgitation, you take them to get a valve repair. So again, treating those is going to be the key thing. Obstructive shock, if you are blessed enough to be able to see this, you know, whenever these do happen, like a tension pneumothorax, you needle decompress them potentially, but I think ultimately just put that chest tube in. That's going to be the beneficial thing. If you see a cardiac tamponade, shout out to our cardiac tamponade podcast, go check that out. then you stab that needle in there, you tap that pericardial cavity and you pull off some fluid via pericardiocentesis. And then again, if they have a big whopping PE, like a saddle embolus, you need to definitely consider potentially, again, if it's a massive PE, usually it's TPA or an embolectomy. Septic shock, that's a whole different story though. Septic shock is a big one. This is probably one of the most challenging ones and the one that you probably most likely see in these with patients in the hospital is with a septic shock, you have to figure out what's the cause. So you have to go and figure out what's going on. Because if you just start a patient on IV antibiotic, that's great. But if the IV antibiotics aren't clearing like an abscess or they have some type of like septic focus that the IV antibiotics can't penetrate, you need to go and drain that or figure out what it is. It's all source control with septic shock. And then the other thing is, again, IV fluids. IV fluids are somewhat beneficial, but you don't want to crush them with like 10 liters of fluid. So try to be able to, you know, carefully volume resuscitate your patients adequately. But one of the big things is going to be vasopressors. That's kind of the hallmark behind these patients because you have to keep that perfusion pressure up, that MAP, that mean arterial pressure. And generally, for most of these conditions, you're aiming for a MAP of like greater than 65. That seems to be the number that it's pretty much universal across multiple literature sources that, again, MAP of greater than 65 is generally the pressure target that you're aiming for if you're utilizing vasopressors. So those would be things that you would utilize, such as, like, again, you can use things like norepinephrine, you can use things like phenylephrine, you can use like things like epinephrine, you can use vasopressin, you can use angiotensin II. So there's a lot of different medications that we can use out there to support the pressure in these situations. The next one is anaphylactic shock. Anaphylactic shock, honestly, the best thing for these patients is epi, Rob. So, you know, generally it's going to be IM epi. If you really want to, you can't go wrong with it. You can do things like IV epinephrine if you need to, if you don't have access to it. But IM epinephrine is going to be the kind of the big thing. You can't consider IV. And generally, if you're trying to be able to reduce some of the other symptoms, not necessarily the shock state, but the symptoms, you can reduce some of the inflammation with antihistamines and steroids. But the baseline kind of like background treatment that you need is epinephrine. And then lastly, neurogenic shock. Again, if you're trying to support the blood pressure, these patients are usually bradycardic and hypotensive. So epinephrine might actually be a beneficial thing. Isoproterenol, if they're really, really like bradycardic, you can consider that. They could probably get a heart rate out of a rock. But generally, those are the best things to do. And again, trying to treat the underlying issue with these patients. But yeah, I think that would be the big thing here with the treatments of shock, Rob.
Alrighty, guys. There you have it. Episode 9, shock, done in just over a half hour. Now, we're getting pretty good, Zach. We're getting pretty good.
Man, that was a half hour. I thought this was like, I thought we were at 3 hours already.
No, dude. 35 minutes. We're cruising. Got all of the most important information down. We hope you guys enjoyed it. Again, make sure to check out ninjanerd.org. Get a membership. Join up. We promise you guys will love it. But before we close off here, Zach, any thoughts, any other pearls of wisdom you have here?
Yeah, so shock is definitely a tough topic. I mean, it's really one of those tough ones out there. But I think for your USMLE, your STEP 2, your PANTS, all those like NCLEX boards exams, I think it's really important to understand the categorization of the different types of shock, understand the basic pathophysiology of them. Again, I know this is unfortunate, but trying to know those hemodynamic parameters off of the Swan-Ganz catheter is actually going to be something that might actually be helpful within the clinical vignettes that they present you. On your actual exams. But being thoughtful in the true reality in the clinical world involves a lot of just a true cognitive rational thinking and analyzing the underlying cause. So figuring out what's the actual likely cause and figuring out what's the best test, what's the best thing that I need to do for my patients. But yeah, this can be a really challenging topic. There can be a lot of cognitive dissonance with this, and there's a lot of literature that's constantly changing with this topic nonstop. So I hope that you guys did like it. I hope that you guys enjoyed it. And Ninja Nerds, as always, until next time.